This is Bobby Humphrey. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
On the count.
The U.S. prison system incarcerates approximately 2.5 million people, the highest number of any industrialized nation, while prisons remain the fastest growing industry in the country.
My people inside and out, where you at? You're listening to 99.5 FM WBAI. This radio show is called On the Count, the Prison and Criminal Justice Report. My name is Andre Ward, and I'm joined by my dear colleagues and friends and leaders, Harmony and Madi, who are joining us here today in studio. But as always, we're grateful and honored to be able to come inside the cells and the dorms by way of the airways to share with you what's happening in the world around the criminal legal reform movement, some news, some other commentary and analyses as it relates to criminal legal reform. And today, you know, we're going to have a really powerful show. I'm really excited about this show as always. But before we get to that, we want to say hello to Madi and to Harmony. Harmony, how are you doing this morning?
Good morning, everybody. So glad you're here. Where are my people at? We are motivated and fired up this morning. We know that Harmony has just come down off the Zoom class. Shout out to the women who are also doing Zoom this morning in Bedford, Taconic, Ibeon. Don't forget Rikers Island and Rosie's. We also want to big up the men, but you know we have to shout out the women. Big ups to everyone. Welcome, everyone, this morning. We're in for a bright show, and I hope everyone is well. Keep hope alive.
Absolutely. And Madi will be joining us soon, our Latinx Affairs producer. She'll be joining us. Obviously, this month marks Black History Month. And for some others, we may feel that Black History Month is every day. But it is acknowledged in this country as being Black History Month. And, you know, before we go on to the show, just want to really acknowledge that Trayvon Martin, who was killed or gunned down, would have been 26 years old yesterday. And I know that people are acknowledging him in silence, and we lift him and his family up. We just want to make sure we're acknowledging that. There's also news of note in the policy world with Walking While Trans bill has been passed by the governor, which is a big deal for our LGBTQI community and for all of us who support human beings being able to be honored for who they are. And so I just wanted to add those two things, but want to get right into the show. I got three very, very powerful leaders on this call with me this morning. I'm grateful for their contribution to the movement in so many different ways. And our subject today is about education and obviously about the restoration of Pell to support higher education in prisons. And the leaders I have on today is none other than Max Kenner, Diwan Tatro, and someone who's no stranger to our show. Obviously, I mean, Max has been no stranger to the show, and certainly Diwan, but we have none other than Vivian Nixon, who joins us. And so we're going to have a really rich conversation about some of the historical context around education, what the impact of Pell will have now that it's been restored. Talk a little bit about TAP restoration and what happens in the future. So Max, Diwan, Vivian, good morning. How's everybody feeling this morning? Thank you for joining us here at On the Count.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Great to be back. Thank you, Andre.
Good morning, Andre.
Yes, good morning. So we want to get right into it, right? You know, I know that currently, like, Vivian, as the executive director of College and Community Fellowship, has taken up the mantle to push the advocacy efforts to reestablish Pell within the prisons. Kind of want to give a little historical context, Vivian, about Pell. How did it start, like, and then what happened to it? And then I want to jump to Max and Diwan, obviously, because of the BARD initiative work that you all have been involved in for so many years, particularly you, Max, and Diwan, your involvement and engagement with that whole educational push. So, Vivian, give us a little historical context around Pell.
Certainly. Thank you. And for the record, Max is much more of a historian than I am. So if I get the dates wrong, Max will certainly correct me.
Cool.
But Pell Grant.
For the record, Vivian is the only professor on the line right now.
All right. And so before you got on, Vivian, Max was like, well, you know, Vivian got to make sure. So that's what that is, right? So we just, no, but we get it. And just really, I'm just really excited to see you all in the same room. It's hard to get people in the same room.
Oh, I'm excited to be here. Yeah. And this is a very important topic to me and to all of us on this call. And indeed, to I think every marginalized population that has been denied equal access to education in the United States for a variety of reasons since the inception of the idea of creating a United States of America. So Pell Grants were initiated by Senator Claiborne Pell of Rhode Island as an idea in, I believe, 1968 was when the legislation was first passed to provide federal support for college students who would not otherwise be able to afford to go to college. So it was an income-based federal project to help everybody have access to higher education. And in 1972, higher education programs in prisons began to be funded by these federal dollars. So colleges all over the country, public and private, community colleges of all kinds would go into prisons and their tuitions would be paid through Pell Grants. Courses were available in more than 350 prisons across the United States at the height of the use of Pell Grants in prisons. And in 1994, the infamous crime bill that was passed by the Clinton administration was the seat of a very heated debate about whether or not people in prison deserved access to these grants, or indeed deserved access to college education at all. It became a debate that characterized prisoners in language that we are actually familiar with today, right? Where certain categories of people are dehumanized and considered less than and not worthy of. It was giving education to people in prison was compared to putting lipstick on a pig. And other disgusting terms. So as part of that legislation, Pell Grant eligibility was removed from incarcerated students. And within a matter of weeks or months, all of those 350 college programs from across the country were reduced to about 8. And that was only because a select number of colleges found that their values would not allow them to abandon those students who were incarcerated. New York State led the way, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of creating a coalition of educators and other people who care about this issue to build various consortium of colleges, independent colleges, private colleges, to say we are not going to let college disappear from our prisons. One of those colleges is Bard College. Bard Prison Initiative was a leader in this movement, as was Marymount Manhattan College, who kept the Bedford program going, Hudson Link, that kept the Sing Sing program going. So many dedicated educators just knew that education had such a value, was such a transformative experience, and had proven to be an effective means of accomplishing the goals, not only the public safety goals that corrections and policing officials cared about, but the community goals that we all care about, creating strong, healthy communities where the well-being of everybody is a priority. So we fought to get Pell Grants back ever since 1994. There was no break in terms of people fighting to get Pell Grants back. Immediately, people fought back. But when the reentry craze began under George Bush, that famous State of the Union, everybody deserves a second chance. America is the land of second chances. And he specifically said people deserve access to housing, jobs, and substance abuse treatment. And those were the three pillars that he rested on. And I said to myself, well, there's a pillar missing. That's a three-legged stool. We need a four-legged stool. And the fourth leg is education. And that's when I began to bring education into the conversation about reentry and reentry success. That's when I met Max.
Absolutely.
And other people. We formed a coalition. And now Pell Grants have been restored as of December. We're just waiting for the implementation.
That's a huge victory, too. And thank you for that context, Vivian. And I want to circle into Max, right? Because Bard, along with Hudson Link and others, stayed around once there was a suspension or doing away with the Pell. Max, talk about that struggle, though, because I'm sure there was a struggle, right? Keeping Bard in existence while in prison, some of the bric-a-brac you may have received from officials, because why are you in here, right? Teaching these people, et cetera. Talk about a little bit about that and just some history around Bard College Initiative.
Sure. Thanks, Andre. And it's terrific to be here. And I'm so glad we have an hour because, you know, we always joke that this work is hard to talk about in a really pithy or short kind of way, because everything we do happens at the confluence, at the intersection of two different crises in American life. One is what we now call mass incarceration. And the other is the disparities, inequities, inequalities in how we provide education, particularly high quality, rigorous education in the United States. And we don't really have a language for talking about those two things at once. So just to say, it's important in our view to talk about both when we talk about this issue. And the more we talk about it, actually, historically, at least from our perspective at BPI, the Bard Prison Initiative, we think these are kind of the same, you know, different sides of the same coin. We can't have one without the other. We don't think we'd really have mass incarceration if we had equitable distribution of education in the United States and vice versa, right? So just to build on a little of history that Vivian mentioned, just to say there has been some kind of educational aspiration sprinkled in the history of American prison systems for well over 100 years. She's absolutely right. The modern history of college and prison begins with Pell, but it goes back farther than that. There was, you know, inklings of college in San Quentin and other places 100 years ago. Malcolm X, I think we can say, went to college and prison. Not in the exact form that we would do it now, but Malcolm X in Massachusetts went to college and prison. So there's a long history of incarcerated people working and finding a way to make the best use of their time in a serious and frankly formal kind of way through college, right? And it's also worth noting that, you know, when we think about the history of mass incarceration beginning roughly same time period that Vivian described, 1968, 1972, depending how you, you know, do your chronology. The history of college and prison, the vast kind of expansion of college in the prison happens organically because of availability to Pell and happens concurrent with the growth of the prison system. So it's a kind of cross current. We have this awful, inhumane story of the growth of the prison system, but within it, this sort of organic manifestation of literally hundreds of little colleges in those prisons across the United States created at the grassroots level. So just an example of how history works in mysterious ways sometimes. And when in 1994, Pell Grants were stripped, it's just worth noting. I mean, there's a lot of things just abysmal about that bill. But the evisceration of college and prison was the single most symbolically rich, symbolically important piece of that legislation, because it said not only are we going to invest all this money into our prison systems, but as we do that, as we make prisons a more and more central part of our society, we're going to go out of our way to make them worse. And you have to think about that confluence for a moment, right? If there's nobody in prison, I mean, you know, if there are 10 people in prison, you know, we want them to be treated with dignity, but it's a different thing than if there are 2.5 million people in prison, right? And when we're locking up a generation of people, it becomes all the more important to have more things like education. And that's precisely the moment when the federal government took it away. So Vivian deserves all the credit in the world, and lots of colleagues of ours. We fought for 25 years to restore Pell. It's been the North Star of our field. We spent 25 years fighting to show that college and prison should be. And now we're going to spend the next, hopefully, 6 months or a year fighting to ensure what college and prison will be, which is high quality, serious, democratic education. And the way we're going to do that in New York is by restoring access to the TAP grants, which George Pataki and the legislature destroyed right after the federal government did what they did in 1994. And if we have Pell and we have TAP, there'll be the possibility for high quality college and prison in every prison here in New York State.
Thank you for that, Max. And I want to shift now to Daiwan. You know, Daiwan Tatro, you're part of the movement in the criminal legal reform movement. Education obviously has become important to you, as it is all of us on this call. Your thoughts, Daiwan, on the restoration of Pell, the value of education. Talk to us about that.
You know, and I'm going to back up from there a little bit and begin by saying I did 12 years in prison, Andre. I got an education in prison by the Barred Prison Initiative. I got out of prison in 2017 and kind of hit the ground running, right? And had many opportunities open to me that I would not have been afforded to me if I did not have an education as well as a degree. You know, very important to point out that I have both. And as Max said, in relation to, you know, the quality of educations in prison, we need to be making sure that people are not just being given degrees without the education, right? And so hit the ground running, had a lot of personal success, but, you know, I would go to sleep at night and wake up in the morning thinking about the fact that I have two brothers, one older, one younger. Both of them have been to prison, and neither of them have had access to the type of opportunities that an education afforded me, right? So the value of an education was very stark in my life, right? And so I went back to BPI, went and sat down with Max. I remember we had lunch somewhere in Manhattan and said, I want to raise public money or help to allocate public money towards college and prison. And at this time, you know, the Pell ban was in place. New York State was giving us were giving us at BPI zero funding. New York City wasn't funding our work. I mean, this was extremely important and valuable work, almost entirely dependent on private donors, right? And so that was my impetus into kind of the criminal legal reform space at the nexus of education and mass incarceration, right? And so did some different things. I was able at the tail end of, you know, the Pell advocacy movement. Vivian and Max have been doing this, you know, for 20 or more years. As you know, College Behind Bars came out 2 years ago, and I'm in that documentary. We did several screenings on the Hill in D.C. before different members of Congress and the Senate. I've sat down in meetings with Congress, with Congress, both in the Senate and in the House, talk about the value of education. And I think important to note that not only do we have Pell restoration, we have a full Pell restoration, right? There are no carve-outs. So we got a full return of Pell. That means that if someone is incarcerated with life in prison, they're going to have access to education, right? And that is important practically, because we are currently going through a decarceration movement in this country. And I think that, you know, we're going to see a lot of those life sentences commuted eventually, that people are going to recognize the ridiculousness of that practice. But it's also important symbolically, right? We need to be nurturing some type of faith in human dignity. Even if someone is in prison, they have a right to an education. So we have full Pell restoration. I was really glad and able to work on the tail end of that, to step in the shoes of women like Vivian, of men like Max. And as Max mentioned, you know, here we are in New York following Pell, and TAP still hasn't been restored. And Vivian Nixon and Stephanie Bazell, who's the director of policy over at CCF, they began to launch a campaign around TAP restoration here in New York last year. That got truncated by COVID. They have relaunched that campaign, and we at BPI are happy to do what we can to support that, to work in tandem with them, because as Max said, if we can get TAP back following Pell, we can really build college and prison in a robust and rigorous way. And that's what I've been doing, and I take heart from it every day, because I know that there are incarcerated men and women in New York State who are going to greatly benefit from an access to an education.
Thank you for that, Dewan. But I want to throw something in the mix, everybody, right? I'm the taxpayer, right? My tax dollars are paying for people in prison to get an education. The taxpayer is saying, not I'm saying, but the taxpayer is saying, why should we do it? My children are not given access to get college education, but people, these people inside are able to get access to higher education. What will be our response to that? And I'll start with you, Vivian. I see you smiling at me. Like, what will be our response to that, right? Because, you know, that was one of the things that was lifted up and amplified, right, under the Pataki administration, right, and others, right? So what would be the response to that?
Well, it is a typical political way of twisting the truth, because making people in prison eligible for TAP grants or Pell grants does not make anyone who is not in prison ineligible. So anybody who would have been eligible otherwise is still eligible. So if you're a tax-paying citizen who meets the income guidelines and all the other requirements of the application to receive TAP assistance and Pell assistance, you will still receive TAP assistance and Pell assistance. If you are a private citizen, taxpaying citizen who is in an income bracket that puts you above eligibility, you probably pay less taxes than the people who are eligible in terms of a percentage of your income, and you're just not eligible. But that's the way the program was designed. So everybody who is eligible based on income will still have access. No one is denied because someone is in prison has access?
It's a question, believe it or not, Andre, that we've gotten before. And it's hard. Are we allowed to curse on this show?
No, we aren't.
Okay, good to know. Because it's a hard question to answer because it's such BS. And there's so many good reasons why it's nonsense. And Vivian laid out a few of them. Your children are eligible for Pell. Your children are eligible for TAP. And we could keep going, right? I'll also tell you that as someone who works as an administrator at a college, right, and we look out at the American landscape, we know we're failing at engaging American talent, American capacity, and when we find ways to do it successfully and affordably, we shouldn't eliminate those, we should build upon those, and we can talk more about ways we might do that in the future. But most importantly, Andre, I want to get back to 1994 and 1995, because we're focusing this conversation on the restoration of TAP here in New York, and just say that that argument was certainly nationally and in New York central to the demise of college and prison in the state and in the country. It was an argument that was vindictive, it was hateful, it was punitive, it was second only to arguments in favor of capital punishment in stating what we thought the value of people in prison were at that time, at the peak of the tough on crime frenzy in the United States. But I also just want to say where I believe this issue, it fits in certainly the issue of mass of college and prison, but even the larger issue of mass incarceration fits in American history. And to say that argument specifically is a lie. And the reason it's a lie, not from the guy or the mother, or father on the street that's struggling to pay for his child to go to college, her child to go to college, because they need help sending their child to college. And nobody's disputing that. We're saying there should be more help for that. But for the elected official, for the politician, for the governor, for the legislator making that argument, in reality, at that time, it was a lie. And the reason it was a lie, the reason we can prove it's a lie, is because while those elected officials were focusing voters' attention, were focusing the media's attention on, let's just say it, poor, incarcerated, black and brown, mostly men, at that time, people to fear, people to, that they thought voters could easily resent. They were taking education away from everyone. It's Du Bois 101, right? They were saying, look at these people you hate because of your bigotry, and let's treat them worse. Let's be cruel. And oh, while you're looking over there, I'm going to pick your pocket and destroy the state's university system. And that's exactly what happened. In 1988, we spent twice as much on college in New York as prisons. And by 1998, we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars more per year on prisons than our state university system.
Yeah, Andre.
No. Daiwan, I see you itching to the bit, yeah. Right? And so, yeah, Daiwan, come on.
As Max said, you know, it's that argument is so bad and so false that there are many different ways to refute it. But to pick up where Max left off, you know, we live in a society that will spend more money to incarcerate you, quite simply, than it will to educate you, right? So to anyone who says to me, why should we be incarcerating people in prison? Like, why do you think the state should be spending my tax dollars on that? I say to them, have you ever questioned the state spending your tax dollars to incarcerate that person rather than educate them, right? It costs over $70,000 in New York State to incarcerate a person. It costs about $8 to educate them. The state currently spends over $3 billion a year on prisons and less than $1 billion on tuition assistance to students. And by the way, we know that education radically transforms the trajectory of anyone's life. We also know that mass incarceration is a monumental failure, right? And just add a point to what Max said, in 1994, when they eliminated Pell, that same bill allocated $7 billion to prison construction, enough money to fund college and prison for 200 years.
Can you repeat that again, Daiwan?
That same bill allocated $7 billion to prison construction, right? And so it's never a question of the money. It's never a question of the tax dollars, because you're going to pay the tax dollars regardless. It's a question of what those governors, those legislatures are going to do with your tax dollars, right? It is a question of priorities. And what we see with respect to Black and brown communities, the priority, the impetus has been to over-police, to incarcerate, to oppress, to harass, rather than to educate, right? And so often in this work, especially at BPI, we are confronted too often with individuals who want to place and situate our work in the criminal justice space, right? And I understand that. But ultimately, we're a college, right? And the work that we do is about expanding access to education. And when you're talking about doing that in prison, you're having a coded conversation about race, because the people we incarcerate in New York State are Black and brown, right? And so this is an education equity issue par excellence, you know, as Vivian has pointed out, and we can never lose that lens when we're having a conversation about tax dollars, right? Because in America, those governors, those legislators, those politicians and senators, those presidents, right, over the past 30 years have used communities of color as a straw man to strip social services and resources from Americans in general. And so,
Yes, Harmony is in the conversation. You know, I was going to jump right in. You didn't think I was going to sit home all day, did you? Mm-mm. So you're 100% right. And we know, congratulations on getting the work done to be able to have education back into the facilities and have people have access to that conversation. I mean, to education. But, and congratulations to all that worked really, really hard on it. But you're right, Daiwan. So let's just boil that right on down. It's by design, right? So we know that we pull a lot of money, $7 billion into incarceration. We know that. And we know that it's Black and brown people, right? So we know that we're also doing it in our communities now, right? So we also know that we had somebody in the White House that was doing some other things. And it felt like it was all towards people of color. So we know that we've been working really, really hard to oppress and depress a certain segment of our country. So my question is, what is the carrot when you put people back into prison? You know, what is the carrot? What does it take to continue to incarcerate individuals? I don't know whether you know this or not, but during COVID, people were let out. They were allowing people to come out, and, you know, judges were being a little empathetic, just a few. But now we're reincarcerating individuals, right? Because people feel like COVID is over. So what is, when somebody, let me ask that question in another way. When somebody gets a college education, how many of them are actually successful both inside and outside of prison, right? So are you allowing people to come out and be educated and then not go back to prison?
So I think it's a very important question, but I do want to take a moment again and to not allow the value of education to be reduced to a metric of recidivism, right? So this work, you know, educating people should not be about fundamentally curbing recidivism, right? I think we live in a country where we all can agree that everyone has a right to an education, right? Whether you're incarcerated or not. Now, if we take that at the foundation and start for there, we can have many other conversations, but I wanna lay that at the foundation of the conversation. And so we know policymakers knew this in 1994 at the federal level. They knew this in 1995 at the state level, is that if you educated someone in prison, they were the most successful post-release and the least likeliest to ever go back, right? In fact, you know, 2016 RAND Corporation study found that for every dollar a state invests in college and prison, it saves $5 on reincarceration costs. So college and prison is actually a cost-saving mechanism for the state, right? And so the economics of this makes sense. The morality of this makes sense. So as Max and Vivian pointed out, there are really no good arguments against it. We just got to do it and find a political will, especially here in New York, following Pell restoration at the federal level to restore TAP, right? It is past time.
Absolutely.
And beyond that, I think we need to be explicit about the other motivations. There's a flip side to the economic argument. There's a flip side to the recidivism argument, because it's really never been about whether or not the motive was public safety. And it extends beyond the issue of college and prisons. If we go back to pre-Reconstruction, actually pre-liberation of slaves, you will find that the law has been used very strategically in the southern slave states to forbid the education of enslaved people. So the idea was an enslaved people will become educated, and that education does something to their ability to organize, to collectively build power, to influence the direction of the country's aspirations and their economy. And denying that education was directly related to keeping people disempowered and disengaged from our national politic. The motivation is no different when it comes to the prison system. We have seen time periods in our history when access to education created powerful political movements inside of prisons. And that is not the motive that we want. It is voter suppression in another form. It is suppression of the power of originally enslaved people, now African-American incarcerated people, in another form. It's just really hard to see it that way when one doesn't understand collective history, or when one has been fed a bunch of lies in the middle of this Black History Month, that they don't really understand the connections between all of these public policies and systemic and structural racism in the United States.
We're gonna, and thank you for that, Vivian. We're gonna take a really brief break and musical break. You're listening to 99.5 FM WBAI. This radio show is called On the Count, the Prison and Criminal Justice Report. My name is Andre Ward, and I'm joined by esteemed leaders from College and Community Fellowship, Executive Director Vivian Nixon, Max Kinner, who heads up, and I think is Executive Director, apologies for that, Max, you'll let me know, Bard College Initiative, and Dewan Tantra, who also works at Bard College Initiative, and I think is doing some other things, great things too. And we're joined obviously by our dear leaders and producers, Mahdi and Harmony, on the show today. We're going to take a really brief musical break, and then we're going to come back for this very, very powerful and informative conversation on education in prison.
Blackness, keep on.
Sounds of Blackness. Optimistic is the name of the song. And we want to thank Vivian, Max, and Daiwan for supporting us and keeping our heads to the sky, making sure that education is prioritized within the criminal legal, or rather within prisons in particular, and that we continue to advance actions to make sure that TAP is restored on the state level. So we're back. We have maybe around 15 minutes or so, so I want to jump right into it. Future. What does it hold? What are the possibilities? Vivian, I know that at College of Community Fellowship, there's an action that's happening called Turn on the Tap. And when I first heard it, I was like, that's really catchy. This is really interesting and really powerful. So Vivian, we'll start with you. Talk a little bit about that kind of work, what's happening for the future. Wow. Circle back to Max and then Daiwan and the rest of the team on the count, and then we'll wrap up. We got about 15 minutes left, family. Vivian?
Yeah, I'll be brief. So Turn on the Tap, the campaign was conceived of back when the EIO coalition existed about 5 years ago, and we did a health impact study that proved that you know, education has impacts on community health and other issues of well-being. So we liked that the title of that campaign and decided to bring it into the current movement and partnered with BPI and with other people in New York State, and even people from around the country are advising and participating in this campaign. And we want to turn on the tap. We want TAP grants restored to incarcerated students in New York State. We have a fabulous team led by Stephanie Bazell, Evelise Galistra, and Bridget Shanahan, who are doing amazing work getting the word out about this, writing op-eds. Daiwan has been an instrumental partner in that. And we are going to blitz New York with a communication strategy that is going to include endorsements from media, major publications, and hopefully endorsements from all of the citizens who are listening to this show so that we can convince the governor and our legislature that we can afford that money is not the issue here. We can afford to do this. And it is the right moral thing to do to create a more just and equitable society here in the state of New York.
Yeah, absolutely, Vivian. And Max, you said something earlier, right? You talked about building on the future, right? What does that look like for higher education in prisons?
Sure. So I just want to acknowledge where we are and how we got here just very quickly. And it's terrific doing that on this show because of all the people who helped us get here. There's no one who did more for us than Eddie Ellis. So just to say his name,
yes,
say Bob Hausrath's name, I'd like to say that as a precursor to acknowledging where we are now in New York is that even though we have failed as a government to invest in college and prison, that New York benefits from the best system of college and prison in the United States. That happened because, like Vivian said, immediately after the ban in 1994 and 1995, people got to work, and the first place they got to work was here in New York, and the first place they got to work here in New York was in Bedford Hills and the community of incarcerated women and their allies. And that, we want to say that. I want to shout out our friends, first and foremost, at Sing Sing, at Hudson Link, and BPI, and now we've created, you know, a network of independent, high quality, not corrections oriented, to emphasize Daiwan's point, education oriented college and prisons that are not centralized around whether it's recidivism or anything relating to criminal punishment, but about educational aspiration. And we have that system. We need to invest in it. We need to expand it. We need to make sure those programs last. But the future, Andre, is about making what happened in the old days a reality again, a combination of federal and state support, creating independent colleges in the prisons. There are some pitfalls along the way. There are people who want to be responsible for managing an entire system. If they're successful, I'll guarantee you that entire system will become less about the college and more about the prison. That's why we want to emphasize the independence, again, of our partners at Bedford, at Sing Sing, Hudson Link, Cornell, Bard, et cetera, and build on that so New York can continue to be like it was because of the women at Bedford, like it was because of Eddie Ellis, et cetera, a leader in this space as it has been for 25 years.
Taiwan?
Yeah, you know, and this is maybe to harp back on that question of, you know, whether or not someone in prison deserves a degree, right? And a friend of mine was asked that once while we were sitting in the Bard library at Eastern Correctional Facility. And he turned to the questioner and he said, you know, it's not a question of dessert, right? It's not a question of whether or not I deserve a degree, but what I'm going to do with the degree, right? And so I had the great pleasure of sitting down with Senator Montgomery last year before she retired this year, you know, to talk about college in prison.
I want to really acknowledge Senator Montgomery.
Shout out to Belmont Montgomery.
Big shout out.
And by, you know, as an aside,
everybody loves Senator Montgomery.
You know, as an aside, there's an amazing picture of Max, Vivian, Elliot Spitzer, some other individuals from way back in the day as a token of, you know, how long they've been doing this work. But one of the things, you know, the senator said to me, she said, you know, the reason why this is so important is because we need more people like you coming out of prison with an education and an experience that is going to help change the world, right? And so, you know, the future for me, the future for any other graduate of college and prison, kind of the sky's the limit. I'm really, really proud to announce, you know, announced the other day, but we'll share it here because it's relevant to what I'm trying to say. But I just accepted a position as a senior advisor for strategic outreach at the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee in D.C., and me being able to go to D.C. and do this job at this moment in our politics in America is a function of me getting a degree in prison and coming out and being able to leverage that degree, right? And so the future is the more people we are educating in prison, they're going to come out and not only go back, right? I think we take for granted that they're not going to go back, but they're going to come out and do amazing things. And people like Vivian is a testament to that, who someone has come out and his work to make the community, their community specifically, better, right? And I've tried to follow in those footsteps. BPI alumni all over New York City overwhelmingly return to their communities and are working to alleviate the types of things that cause their incarceration in the first place, right? So as we see an expansion of college in prison, I think we're going to see mass incarceration decrease. And mass incarceration is such a monster that we need to be doing everything we can, right? We have to do bail reform. We have to do sentencing reforms. We have to do everything. But one of the things that worries me, Andre, is that we're doing a lot of stuff on the front end to stop sending people to prison. We're doing a lot of stuff on the back end to get people out of prison. We're doing nothing in the middle for the millions of people who are in prison, right? And if we're really going to end mass incarceration, we have to do something for those people because over 95% of them are coming back to their communities. And if they come back to their communities with a college degree, with part of an academic community, they are going to be better off. And so future, you know, for me, we're going to expand college and prison. We're going to educate more people, those people who run to their communities and do amazing good.
Thank you for that.
Build power.
Absolutely. Exactly. And I know our producer, Latinx Affairs producer, Marty, had a question for you all before we go. We have like maybe 1 minute left.
Yeah. So I wanted to especially thank you guys for coming on our show prior to entering the criminal justice field as an individual that works towards reducing pretrial detention. I was a 15-year high school English teacher, and I witnessed the school to prison pipeline, which is why I morally just couldn't continue working in that system and had to transfer over into the criminal justice field. Now, I would love to have you guys back to further discuss the prison to school pipeline.
So that they win.
Okay.
Yes.
Got it.
So much to unpack here. There is so much to unpack, and we can't do it in one show, but I definitely would love to invite all three of you back to discuss the prison to school pipeline, since the school to prison pipeline was such a big cahoot, especially with third grade exams. I really want to see what's in the future of the prison to school pipeline. So please come back to our show.
Yes, of course they'll be back. They're friends of ours. But let me just say,
we have some announcements coming down the pike for you.
Wonderful. Let me just make sure that we say, because there's something that was just a little missing from the middle of this, and that is, so College and Community Fellowship and BARD have been doing this work continuously, even when there was no PAL. So please understand that those two entities were still educating individuals who are incarcerated. Please make sure you go to College and Community Fellowship website, as well as BARD website. Please make sure you go there and give your support to them. You can reach out to Vivian Nixon on that site, and you can reach out to Max Kenner as well. And I think that Mr. Daiwan is also at BARD. And also, Max has on a sweatshirt that I don't have. It says a big BPI. We need that over here. But you're listening to 99.5 WBAI. You are on the count. The Prison and Criminal Justice Report. We thank you so much and want to have you back as soon as possible. Andre?
And as we always say, as we speak about Eddie Ellis posthumously, in his famous words, he would say in closing, don't give in, don't give out, don't give up, stand tall in spite of it all, and stay on the count.
Big up to Sean.
No changes. Wake up in the morning and I ask myself, is life worth living? Should I blast myself? I'm tired of being poor and even worse, I'm black. My stomach hurts, so I'm looking for a purse to snatch. Cops give a damn about a Negro. Pull a trigger, killing, he's a hero. Get a to the kids who the hell cares. One less hungry mouth on the welfare. First ship them, don't let them deal with brothers. Give them guns, step back, watch them kill each other. It's time to fight back, that's what Huey said. Two shots in the dark, now Huey's dead. I got love for my brother, but we can never go nowhere unless we share with each other. We gotta start making changes. Learn to see me as a brother instead of two distant strangers. And that's how it's supposed to be. How can the devil take a brother if he's close to me? I let it go back to when we played as kids, but then it changed. And that's the way it is. Come on, come on.
That's just the way it is. Things will never be the same. That's just the way it is. Oh yeah.
WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. You just heard On the Count. Coming up at 11 o'clock, normally you'd hear From the Streets with Bob Law, but that is not on today. It'll be back next week. Instead, you'll hear a special edition of Equal Rights and Justice with Mimi Rosenberg. But first, a little station business, so please stay tuned.
33 cents a day. Not much, is it? Loose change. A third of a cup of coffee. It's nothing. But did you know that 33 cents a day can help WBAI stay on the air? That's all it takes. As little as 33 cents a day. $10 a month. You can be a BAI buddy. A BAI buddy is someone who signs up to make a recurring monthly donation to WBAI using either a credit card, debit card, or by electronic fund transfer from your bank account. It's safe, secure, and easy, and it helps keep our unique, alternative, and diverse programming on the air. You'll get a WBAI membership card and other goodies. Sign up online. Go to WBAI.org and click on donate. All the details are right there. The WBAI buddy. Be one today.
I'm Marcia Pendleton, producer and host of Backstage Stories. Tune in Saturday, February 6th at 9 p.m. We'll kick off Black History Month and explore On Love, a new work by award-winning playwright Infoniso Udafia. On Love actor Chike Johnson and its director Owoye Tempo will join us for an extraordinary evening of music and conversation that's all about Black love. Join us for Backstage Stories.
He's cool. He's exciting.
This dude is bad.
He's sexy. Okay, maybe not. He's a bad mother.
Shut your mouth.
He's Tony Ryan. On WBAI New York 99.5 FM. He's got both.
Break him with the sound of the trumpet.
Can you dig it?
Yeah, I can dig it, yeah.
He's got classic soul. He's okay. I can't think of anything else.
I'm Tony Ryan. Tune in Saturday nights, 10 p.m. to 1 a.m.
Soul Central Station with Tony Ryan.
99.5 WBAI.
It's autumn. The birds and ear massage are migrating to Sundays, 6 to 8 a.m. I'm Mark Leosa, your ear masseur, inviting you to give ear to ear massage, sound, spoken word, a bit of opera, and maybe music you never heard before, including the Bird of the Week. Ear massage between Jeff Brady in other news and your morning Ursay with James Ursay here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Ear massage.
I'm Anat Gerstein from Anat Gerstein, Inc. Helping nonprofits is what we do. Nonprofits are working in overdrive to respond to the pandemic. They're running homeless shelters, providing health and mental health services, caring for kids in foster care and homebound seniors and those who are hungry, and much more. They're also delivering educational entertaining content straight to our homes, and they're doing it all with less. So let's come together to support nonprofits today. Look for the hashtag #SupportNonprofits on social media to learn more.
This is WBAI, and this is Fred Eagle Smith for WBAI in New York. Stick it in your ear.
All right. Thanks a lot. Picket lines and picket signs.